Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of The Shift Network. The Everyday Peace series is designed to provide you with insights and tools for cultivating peace in your daily life. We're so grateful that you're here. Please do share your questions or insights on facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, Philip Helmick, the Director of Peace at the Shift Network.
Oh, welcome back to the Summer of Peace. I'm Philip Helmick, the Director of Peace at the Shift Network, and I am so delighted with this session of the Everyday Peace Series. We have as our special guest Dr. Rick Hansen, and we will be looking at positive neuroplasticity, the new brain science of lasting inner peace. And this is a topic that is really dear to my mind and heart, as it's one that really bridges modern science and ancient wisdom from different meditation traditions. And so let me say a little bit about Rick, introduce Rick, and welcome him to us to this session. Dr. Rick Hansen is a psychologist, senior fellow of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, and New York Times bestselling author. His books include Hardwiring Happiness, Buddha's Brain, Just One Thing, and Mother Nature. He's the founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. He's been an invited speaker at Oxford, Stanford, and Harvard, and taught in meditation centers worldwide. He has several audio programs. His free Just One Thing newsletter has 100,000 subscribers. And his year-long program on positive neuroplasticity, the foundations of well-being, is now available as an e-course. For many years, Rick served on the board of Family Works, a family resource agency in Marin County, California, and he chaired it for 2 years. He currently serves as a trustee of the Saybrook University. And Rick began meditating in 1974 and has studied and practiced in several traditions. At the end of 2008, he completed a 9-year term on the board of the Spirit Rock Meditation Center, a very well-known center here in Northern California. A graduate of the Community Dharma Leader Training Program, he leads a weekly meditation group in San Rafael, California, and he has taught at the Barra Center for Buddhist Studies, New York Insight, the Salty Center, and other meditation centers. Rick and his wife, Jan, live in San Rafael, California. They have 2 college-age children, and Rick's personal interests are rock climbing, selling novels, travel, and he's lived 1 year in Finland and 1 year in Germany. And Rick, just welcome, and thank you for being here with us at the Summer of Peace.
Philip, thank you very much, and truly, it is an honor to be here, and I cannot think of anything more important than contributing to the cause of world peace.
Well, Rick, you know, in preparing for the session, I've been looking into websites. I just want to mention to it, what you're bringing to the subject of peace is just profound. And I want to encourage the listeners now to go to rickhansen.net. There's so many incredible resources. And Rick, when I look at this, I mean, you're really bridging these worlds of science and meditation and bringing the ancient wisdom forward in ways that's just profound. How did you personally get started in this area of science and overlap with meditation?
The short version is that I was suffering. In other words, going back to young childhood, I just had the sense that there was a lot of unnecessary unhappiness in my neighborhood, in my schools, watching the grown-ups, in my own family. And I just longed in my heart, as I think so many young kids do, who can't even put words to it. There's a sense that, wow, something different is really possible. This is crazy. And then as I became an adult, into my college years and then in my 20s, I started really looking hard at what would it take to actually cause lasting, durable happiness, both inside people and between people out there in the world. And that led me into psychology and the human potential movement. We're talking, the early 70s and also led me into the contemplative traditions of the world, particularly Buddhism, the one that I know best. And along the way, also starting, I'd say, in my mid-20s, I became more and more interested in the underlying nervous system, because while I myself think there really is an X factor outside the natural frame of things, so-called, of kind of mind and matter in the ordinary sense, something transcendental, something divine, inside the natural frame, clearly, the nervous system is the final common pathway of most, if not all, of the causes streaming through us to make this moment of experience, hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and also thinking, feeling, wanting, suffering, or having inner peace, right? So if you think of the combination that we're sum up here, the intersection of three circles, brain science, that's the hardware, psychology, that's kind of the software, and then contemplative wisdom, that's sort of the Uber software. If you think of the intersection of those three circles, that's the sweet spot that's been home base for me over the last 30, 40 years in my career, in which I've been really interested as a practical guy in finding skillful means at the intersection of those three circles for lasting peace as well as lasting contentment and love.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, Rick. I love this overlapping circle, hardware, software, and then the Uber software.
That's right. If not, you know, the Uber transcendental, but I'm happy to stay inside the natural frame here.
Yeah, well, I think that's important, because one of the things I've really been enjoying about, you know, some of the articles you've written, you've really made some, both the ancient science and the modern science, very accessible. So let's get down to some nitty-gritty here. So let's just look at how to cultivate peace inside, and what are some of the tendencies towards the brain that I was reading about in your articles? Could you explore that with us?
Yeah, there's kind of a good news, bad news thing going on here that has a huge implications for both, you know, cultivating the causes of lasting inner peace, as well as developing resources inside yourself, resourcing yourself to sustain the good fight in some sense. In other words, to sustain peacemaking and social justice work in the world. All right. So good news, bad news. Good news is that when people experience that their core needs are met, and this is also true for other non-human animals like monkeys, dogs, zebras, even in some primitive sense, lizards, let's say. When an animal, like a human, experiences that one's core needs are met, and particular for the three great categories of needs that that animals need to take care of, safety, satisfaction, and connection. When we experience that our core needs are met, under these umbrella headings of safety and satisfaction and connection, the brain and body defaults to its resting state. People call it, I call it the responsive mode. It's like a setting. I call it the green zone for simplicity. And that's good. In the green zone, you know, animals, including humans, chill out. We conserve resources. It's a very good place to be in terms of survival in the wild. We repair and refuel from and recover from bursts of stress. And because the green zone is good for us, we've evolved ways that it feels good for us. So in terms of those basic needs, safety, satisfaction, connection, we have a sense broadly of peace and contentment and love. Peace for safety, contentment for satisfaction, love for connection. That's the good news. Here's the bad news. We are dislodged from this home base really easily. Whether back in the Serengeti, it was the crack of a twig in the brush nearby that signaled that a lion was creeping up on your baby. Or today, a frown across the dinner table, getting stuck in traffic, worrying about money, you know, not happy about the political direction of your country, let's say, whatever it might be. And then that tips us into the red zone when we go into fight or flight. And in the red zone, you know, it's bad for the body and in the mind. Because it's bad for the body, it feels bad. We're designed to go into the red zone briefly, unlike the modern chronic situation of ongoing mild to moderate stress. So in the greens, in the red zone, because it's bad for us, it feels bad. And so in terms of peace, content, pardon me, safety, satisfaction, and connection, the mind has a sense of fear, frustration, and heartache. Right, kind of that's the big picture model. So the point is, we don't have a choice about our basic needs. We don't have a choice about the 600 million year evolution of the nervous system that's embedded inside our heads today, kind of an inner lizard, mouse, and monkey, inside every one of us, related to, you know, safety, satisfaction, and connection. We don't have a choice about that. Our only choice is how to increasingly rest in the green zone, even when the world is flashing red. It's easy to be in the green zone when someone's rubbing your feet and brushing your hair at the same time or whatever, you know, or it's the end of a day, or there you are, super chill in yoga camp, all right, fine. That's easy. But how do you stay in the green zone when you're sitting down with the in-laws and they're just crazy, or, you know, your kid is yelling at you, or you're stuck in traffic and you're late for a meeting and your cell phone's not working? What do you do then, right? That's why, as we will get into, I think it's so important to draw on the science of positive neuroplasticity, to use everyday experiences to deeply internalize resources so that you feel safe in your core, so that you have the underlying basis for inner peace, and also so that you repeatedly internalize resources using positive neuroplasticity to develop inner strengths like resilience, grit, commitment to justice, gratitude, compassion, kindness, and so forth, so that you can sustain peacemaking over time.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, Rick. Wow, this is so well said. When I'm reflecting on it in your articles, it sounds like it really takes an effort to develop positive neuroplasticity, because there's a tendency of focusing on the threats. Could you say a little bit more about that tendency, and then let's go into how we can consciously cultivate the positive?
Yeah, it's part of the good news, bad news. So good news, you know, there's a long-standing question, what is human nature, right? Are we saints or sinners, angels or devils, what have you? Modern neuropsychology would say, hey, we have two natures, green zone, red zone. The good news is that our home base, our equilibrium condition, our sustainable place, where we long to go to and where we naturally default when our basic needs are met, and more exactly, we experience them as being met. You know, there are a lot of deeply happy and peaceful people who are quite poor, and there are a lot of deeply unhappy, aggressive, and not peaceful people living in Beverly Hills, you know, on over $1 million a year. So the bottom line really is, what do you experience deep down inside yourself? Okay, so the good news is, when you experience core needs being met, you know, like there's an enoughness of safety. You don't need to be anxious. There's an enoughness of satisfaction. You don't need to feel desperate, and instead can feel grateful for what you do have. You know, there's an enoughness of being cared about, of feeling loved and loving, so you don't have to get caught up in feeling really hurt or ashamed or aggressively conflicted with other people. All right, good. That's the good news, all right? But the bad news, other side of it, is that the brain has what's called a negativity bias, which means we're highly reactive to anything that feels like our core needs not being met, because as our ancestors evolved, in effect, they needed to get both carrots, but also avoid sticks, carrots like food, you know, sticks like predators. But the difference is, if you fail to find that carrot today, you'll have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But in the wild, in which most animals died, including our ancestors, in the moment of being eaten by some other animal, right? Mm-hmm. If you fail to avoid that stick today, whack, no more carrots forever. So we have a brain that, even when we're in the green zone, actually, you can just watch your mind, especially if you have any, you know, mindfulness practice, you can watch it continually scanning for danger or threats or looking for something new to want, even though you're perfectly satisfied already, or looking for some sign of something going wrong in your relationship. So we continually scan for bad news as part of the negativity bias. And then when we find the bad news, we isolate down upon it, ignoring the big total mosaic of reality, just looking at that one tile in the mosaic that's flashing red on the inner dashboard. And then we overreact to it. For example, inside an MRI, if you play sounds for people that are equally loud, the brain will react more to the sounds that are unpleasant, right? And then that whole business is fast-tracked into emotional memory. Once burned, twice shy. You know, we remember negative interactions with others more than positive ones. We're more affected by them. You know, if your boss gives you 20 pieces of feedback at your annual review and 19 are positive and one is room for improvement, what's the one you obsess about for the rest of the day, right? It's the one room for improvement. And then also the stress hormone cortisol that's released when we're just kind of frazzled or irritated or stressed or, you know, anxious or we feel hurt by somebody. That stress hormone goes up into the brain. It sensitizes the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, and it kills neurons in and eventually weakens the nearby part of the brain called the hippocampus, which puts things in perspective and calms down the amygdala, and the hippocampus also calms down the hypothalamus, telling it to quit calling for stress hormones. This creates a vicious cycle in which ordinary experiences of stress and emotional upset today, especially moderate to severe ones and chronic ones, those sensitize us to stress and upset and negative moments and also make us less resilient in the face of them, which means then we're going to be having more stressful experiences and upsetting experiences tomorrow, which then make us really vulnerable to stressful, upsetting experiences the day after that in a vicious cycle. And then that in turn tends to make us more negative with others. In a nutshell, I say we've got a brain that's like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. This is hardwired. There's nothing we can do about it. It was useful for our ancestors. This negativity bias might be useful today under some conditions like a combat tour or growing up in a home or a neighborhood that feels like a combat zone. But for most people, the negativity bias functions as a kind of well-intended universal learning disability, the product of a brain that's evolved for peak performance in Stone Age conditions. What it means is that we overlearn from negative experiences, you know, we get affected very quickly by them, and we underlearn. Here's the problem. We underlearn from positive experiences, even though turning ordinary, beneficial, usually enjoyable experiences, that's what I call positive experiences, turning these beneficial, usually pleasant experiences of caring for others or feeling cared about yourself or gratitude or accomplishment or that you're tough, you're strong, you have grit, you can endure, right? Turning these experiences, which usually feel enjoyable, into neural structure is the primary way to grow resources inside ourselves, like inner strengths of various kinds. And so to me, the bottom line takeaway to wrap up here is that, you know, face the facts. Like for me, I don't believe in positive thinking. I believe in realistic thinking. Realistically, the fact is we have a brain that's designed for survival in Stone Age conditions, but it's not designed for quality of life. It's tilted towards survival, but against quality of life. And that made sense when our ancestors were usually dead by their 30th and certainly 40th birthday. But these days, over the long haul, the short-term benefits for survival of the negativity bias are outweighed by the long-term costs in terms of suffering as well as gradual wear and tear on our physical health and literally shortening of the lifespan. That's why if you tilt today towards your ordinary, beneficial, usually enjoyable, therefore positive experiences, if you tilt toward them today half a dozen times a day, less than half a minute at a time, you're just leveling the playing field. And meanwhile, if you do this tilting toward the beneficial experiences as I've described here, half a dozen times a day, about less than 5 minutes a day, if you do that, you will gradually build up inside yourself the neural substrates of both inner peace as well as the capacity to sustain peacemaking in this troubled world.
Oh, Rick, this is beautiful. I just love it.
Oh, good.
You know, what I love about this, I mean, it just helps explain so much. I mean, it just helps explain evolution. It explains tendencies toward the negative, and also, you know, my study of yoga is talking about how to focus on the positive. Also, it just really brings this all together.
That's great. I'm glad. Yeah.
Well, you know, it just is. I mean, let's get into how to do this. Okay, so we're predominantly wired towards looking for the negative. How do we train?
Well, a little more exactly. There's a quantity effect for the positive. Most people report, with some sad exceptions, obviously, but most people report that most moments are neutral to pleasant over the course of their day, right? Which is interesting. The problem is we're wasting all those good moments on the brain, usually. It's like water through a sieve. But meanwhile, the occasional negative moment has a quality effect. There's a quantity effect for the positive, but an impact effect, a quality effect for the negative. Those negative moments get, boom, caught every time, because that's what we need to learn from for survival. So it's the two working together, to me, that really are important to take into account and to appreciate the fact that every day, the way I look at it is that it's like we walk down a path every day. Every day is a path. We start when we wake up. The end of the path is when we go to sleep. And in that path are dozens, hundreds of ordinary jewels, little moments, little good facts. You get something done. Someone smiles at you. You're thirsty. You drink water. You need to go to the bathroom. You use it. You flush the toilet. That's a good moment, you know, flush toilets, right? You listen to a song. You look out the window. You see a flower. Hundreds of ordinary jewels. The problem is usually people don't notice those ordinary jewels. If they do, they don't feel anything. And even if they notice them and feel something, they don't take the extra 5, 10, 20 seconds to encode that beneficial experience into a lasting change in neural structure or function. You know, if we don't, if we just let our good experiences wash through us like water through a sieve, they're momentarily pleasant, better than a stick in the eye, but they have no lasting value. There's no growth. There's no development. There's no learning. There's no increase in healing or resources for everyday well-being and effectiveness, let alone self-actualization or spiritual practice. That's why I've gotten very interested in empowering people from the inside out to maximize their personal learning curve over the course of the day, which then they can apply to whatever is on their growing edge of learning these days, which could be spiritual perspectives, it could be new ways of interacting with their partner, maybe more skillful ways of dealing with their teenager or their toddler, maybe it's the gradual internalization of feelings of self-worth to counter and antidote old feelings of shame, maybe related to childhood trauma. That's the phenomenal opportunity that people have these days from the inside out. And no one can take it away from you. You know, the man, quote-unquote, might have your fill-in-the-blank, might have your city council, your state legislature, you know, your Supreme Court. But the man, quote-unquote, can never get that sacred place between your own ears where you are in charge of your own personal growth process over the course of a single day.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some nuts and bolts here. Just what are some practices we can do, and then what are the effects of those practices on the brain and mind?
Yeah. So imagine a situation, a very commonplace one, where you have a moment where you feel cared about. All right, and I mean cared about, broadly defined. I think of five aspects of being cared about. One, just being included. Two, being seen. Three, being appreciated. Four, being liked. Five, being loved. Any one of them. Okay, someone cares about you. Your cat crawls into your lap. Your buddies say, hey, come on, man, we're going to have pizza. You feel cared about. What do you do then, right? Or more exactly, you notice the fact that, oh, my cat crawled into my lap. My buddies invited me for pizza. Do you feel anything? So let's suppose that you feel something for a second or two or three, and then it's gone. Well, the nature of learning is a two-stage process. It moves from experiences held in short-term memory buffers that get transferred to long-term storage. In other words, there's a movement from state to trait, activation to installation. Okay, that summarizes thousands of studies on the neuropsychology of learning. You got it, right? Have it, enjoy it. In other words, move from state to trait. The problem is, if we don't stay with an experience long enough, like 5, 10, 20 seconds, there's not enough time for the encoding process to even begin for the experience to move from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. We can learn information in half a second. That's pretty quick. But emotional learning, motivational learning, the building up of resilience inside or happiness inside, or commitment to sobriety or to social justice inside, or the development of things like mindfulness or self-compassion over time, those resources, psychological resources, mental resources, are acquired more slowly because the memory-making systems that are engaged with them are the ones that first evolved around 200 million years ago. They're they're slow, they're older, they're primitive. You know, if you're going to pet the lizard inside, as it were, and repeatedly experience that your safety needs are met, that lizard needs a lot of petting. It's a slow learner. You know, if you're going to feed the mouse inside, as it were, repeatedly internalize experiences of fullness, enoughness, gladness, gratitude, accomplishment, you know, healthy sensual pleasures, you got to feed that mouse a lot. And even the old monkey inside, you know, our social needs broadly defined. You know, the monkeys, the primates arose 40 million years ago. They're kind of slow learners, too. You need a lot of experiences that really get taken in to build up those resources inside. So that's why I coined the acronym HEAL, H-E-A-L, to summarize this fundamental process of the neuropsychology of emotional, motivational, social, spiritual, attitudinal learning, sensory learning, somatic learning, the learning we really care about for healing and emotional intelligence and spiritual intelligence over time. So my acronym HEAL just summarizes this natural process, which I did not invent, but H stands for have the experience in the first place. Look for those experiences that are beneficial for you, and they're usually going to be enjoyable. So the enjoyability of an experience is usually a signal that it would be good for you. It feels good because it is good for you. Okay, have that experience of feeling cared about, let's say, or anything else that's beneficial. And then, most important, install it in your brain by E, enriching the experience, staying with it, helping it grow in your body, you know, opening to it emotionally, letting it become intense, etc. The more the better. And then A for absorb, really sense that this beneficial, positive experience is sinking into you, like feeling cared about is really going into you. And then it's kind of like a fire. You got to light the fire. You have fire, H for have. Then E for enrich, protect the fire. Don't let that inner critic or outer critic rain on your parade. Help yourself sustain this beneficial experience a dozen or two dozen seconds in a row. The famous saying is, neurons that fire together wire together. So the longer those neurons are firing and the more intensively they're firing and the more throughout your whole body they're firing, the more they're going to wire that sense of resilience or happiness or compassion or mindfulness into your own brain. All right? And then A for absorb, using the metaphor of fire. You know, now that you've put logs on the fire and enriching it, keeping it burning, you warm yourself at the fire, you feel like it's sinking into you. You're absorbing it. That's the essence of the process. And then the fourth step, the optional one, L for link, is to be aware of both positive and negative material at the same time. So they start linking the positive to the negative to soothe the negative, to bring perspective and wisdom to the negative, and gradually over time replace the negative, thus giving you the acronym HEAL, H-E-A-L, have, enrich, absorb, and link, which really boils down to four words: have it, get that experience going, but then in particular, enjoy it. So you're installing that activated beneficial state into your brain as a lasting beneficial trait.
Beautiful. Beautiful, Rick. And let's take this in a little bit deeper here. Because you were talking about safety, satisfaction, and also connection, and how these moments of these experiences aren't dependent upon, I'm making an assumption here, aren't dependent upon buying or obtaining different things from the outside. Could you, because there's a little thing here that I'm curious about, because I've seen the Western pursuit of happiness being a hedonic treadmill, I think it's called.
Right. Yeah.
And can you distinguish what you're talking about from a hedonic treadmill?
Good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then just so we can be aware of, you know, it's not necessarily having to go out and buy something to have type of experience.
Yeah, okay. So first, hedonic treadmill, as you well know, it's this idea that people tend to return to their previous baseline after, you know, a major bad event or a major positive event. And while there is some truth to that, new research shows, first, it takes a lot longer to return to baseline after a big negative event than a positive one, thus more evidence for the negativity bias. And second, some people gradually change their set point over time. In other words, they gradually develop more and more of an unconditional basis for well-being. They truly become happier. over time. And the key to that, if you think about it, is the internalization 10,000 times, 10 seconds at a time, of ordinary positive experiences. Because traits are built from states. Our moods, if you will, our lasting moods, our stable moods, are built from lots of passing experiences that get woven into us. With a brain that's really inclined to internalize negative experiences to become increasingly anxious or depressed in our mood. That's why it's really important to look for experiences that are ordinary ones, usually, as you're pointing out, not related to any kind of consumerism, but related to the ordinary experiences of daily life. Like, I'll just give you some quick examples. I'm sitting here at my desk. We're talking via telephone. And if I wanted to, I could take, 5, 10, 20 seconds and just have my mind blown by all the good facts around me, right? Telephones. Is that crazy or what? Thank you, telephones. I see there's a light on my desk. Thank you, electricity, harnessed, I look out the window. I see a beautiful flower. I see little insects buzzing around, fertilizing, going from flower to flower, fertilizing it to create seeds over time. Thank you, bugs and flowers, right? I'm looking out the window more. I see I live on a planet that we're 3.5 billion years in the evolution of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you, right? And that's just in 5 seconds. So I'm really talking primarily about experiences that are beneficial that have to do with ordinary relationships or ordinary experiences of accomplishment, finishing tasks or being grateful or seeing beauty around you, or ordinary experiences of tuning into your own fortitude, your own grit, your own moral compass inside yourself. And it's easy to dismiss these kind of experiences as la-di-da, California, New Age, Hallmark card, sentimental, pie in the sky, rose-colored glasses. I've heard all the critiques, trust me, given what I do. And I just think that's crazy. Like, why dismiss experiences that are enjoyable? They're enjoyable! You know what I mean? You'd wish them for your friends, you and your kids. Why rain on that parade? And second, these enjoyable experiences are usually the basis for growing the good qualities inside, the wholesome qualities of mind and heart, that we need to draw upon for dealing with the crap in everyday life as well as the crap in the larger world. And I hope it's okay to use that C word there.
Yeah.
And so precisely in proportion to how crummy a person's life is, how impoverished they are, how mistreated they are, how discriminated against they are, how disabled they are, how unfortunate they've been, whatever, how anxious or depressed or traumatized they are, the worse it is, the more important it is to look for those ordinary jewels of daily life, those truly existent, actual, good facts around you, and fiercely do not let life defeat you, but open to those beneficial facts and help them become the legitimate basis for beneficial experiences.
Wow, that's beautiful, Rick.
Yeah, and that opportunity is present even in prison. It's present even in poverty. It's present even in Auschwitz. If you think of someone like Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor, who could point out that even in that most hellacious of hells on earth, even there were opportunities in terms of how people responded to their circumstances and what they continued to recognize that was actually still good, that Hitler and his minions could never take away from people. The love in a human heart, for example. Even in that environment, people could find those jewels to weave them into the fabric of their own being. And I find that incredibly hopeful. And frankly, old school, it's on us to do it. The opportunity is beautiful, but the responsibility is on us to make use of that opportunity and to earn the fruits of our own practice. 5 minutes a day, roughly. And you got to do the work. But if you do the work, you're going to earn the fruits, and it's a sweet job.
Oh, Rick, I am so loving that. There's so many, we're coming close to the end of the time here, but there's so many thoughts and reflections. I mean, just A, this really speaks about learning to be present and mindfulness.
Yeah, that's great. You're so right. Because if you're not present, you can't see the good facts. You know, if people are, as you say, caught up in this kind of, I think of the metaphor, you probably know it well, of the land of the hungry ghosts. It's a Tibetan Buddhist metaphor. It's this idea of, I think it so describes modern consumer culture, you know, headquartered in America, frankly, where you have these godlike beings with godlike powers, you know, like big guns and, you know, bombers and aircraft carriers and oodles of money and, you know, blah, 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 who are living in a hell realm fundamentally because their appetites are represented as vast bellies, but their capacities to satisfy their appetites are represented by tiny pinhole mouths. And I see it so bizarre, people wandering through the malls with this look of desperate unhappiness, looking for one more good thing to want. Or people, you know, just dialing through media, looking for one more entertainment, one more fix, one more external source of moving the needle. And that's not going to make them happy, you know. That, which for me, by the way, does speak to what it truly will take to give peace a chance worldwide. You know, I'm all for changing the material conditions out there, right, obviously. In other words, you know, intervening in terms of global warming, you know, intervening in terms of local conflicts of various kinds, doing things to educate girls in third world countries and all kinds of other highly leveraged, intelligent things to do, bringing sanitation to the billion people on our planet. 1 in 7 people on the planet basically have no toilet. They go, you know, they use the fields with all kinds of public health issues as a result. And so I'm all for that. But the truth is, we have the material capabilities to fundamentally take care of the three core needs of every human on the planet starting a year from tomorrow, if we had the political will to do it. We have the means to help everybody on the planet be fundamentally safe and satisfied and connected. And we don't do it. So we need not just the means, but we need the will in terms of inner development, inner change. And second, even in the developed countries of the world where, you know, there is the rule of law and civil society generally, it's not perfect, obviously, but pretty good compared especially to, you know, Game of Thrones. You know, you think about what life was like, you know, 100 years ago, let alone 1,000 years ago. But anyway, in the developed world, there is enough. There are the conditions for safety. There are the conditions for satisfaction. You know, we could feed everybody in the developed world. Most people in the developed world have enough to eat, have their basic needs met, okay? And there is enough rule of law in the developed world so that we don't have intense conflicts between people. And people, you know, there is the basis for feeling loved. But guess what? People are unhappier today in America than they were on average 40 years ago. You know, what's with that? So it's not just changing the standard of living or social institutions that needs to be done. There needs to be a transformative change as well, inside out, in the human heart.
Oh, Rick, you know, thank you for saying this, because this, for me, this is really just really gets to the crux of I feel like a leap that we need to take in humanity is getting off the hedonic treadmill, because, I mean, I've seen firsthand the impact of a global economy fueled by consumerism on people that I love in Sierra Leone. You know, this lack of inner peace in the West fuels an economy that affects people in Sierra Leone, Congo. You know, it fuels child soldiers in Sierra Leone. And yet, it's just beautiful to hear the science coming together with this and the ancient wisdom.
Oh, absolutely. That's great. Yeah.
You described it so well here. And I have to say, I have a lot of compassion for myself and others when stepping out of that not being present to the beauty and the amazement. I mean, I'm looking out the window here, and the leaves are blowing in the wind, and the sun is glistening off the leaves. I'm just like, God, we're on this little ball here, you know, billion stars and galaxies. I mean, it's just like amazing. Just to be able to see this.
Oh, you know, we could just sit here and, you know, it's funny, there's a detail. So I wrote this book on kind of the how of doing this, hardwiring happiness, et cetera. And people can go to my website. Tons of resources are freely offered. Okay, so I'm not pitching my book here. But my point is, you know,
categorically.
Oh, okay, thanks. I went through this, you know, different ways to have a beneficial experience, right? And I came up from my own work and other people, like 16 different ways. One of which, we haven't even talked with, being happy at the good fortune of others. Like, I'm happy right now, Philip, at what a good guy you are. I'm happy there's a good guy like you banging on the drum, you know, doing the best you can. Like, yeah, that makes me happy. And it's so beautifully human to delight in the good fortune of others. In workshops sometimes, I'll have people just sit down and tell each other some of the good stuff going on in their life or things that they're glad about and grateful for. And so A and B, one person talks about it, one person listens, but the listener's job is the sweetest job of all. It's to be happy for their partner that that good stuff is happening, right? And as the Dalai Lama puts it, if you can be happy when others are happy, you'll always be happy. Because there's always somebody somewhere who's happy worldwide, right?
That's beautiful, Rick. Oh, my goodness. You know, I feel like we've just barely scratched the surface of all the things that you and your team are exploring. And oh, my gosh. I just want to say, for me, it's such a gift to hear this, because when I was in the bush in Sierra Leone, living with people on less than $1 a day, I felt a deeper sense of connection.
Yeah.
Then I did and came back to the United States with the rapid pace of life, this is just wonderful. You know, Rick, we're approaching the end of the time here. Any other jewels you would love to share before closing here?
Oh, thank you. Well, the thing, I would offer two things, okay? The first is, really, do not underestimate the power of everyday small experiences. Don't waste them, you know. Give yourself permission. And based on a very tough-minded and clear-eyed recognition of the negativity bias and the importance for growing resources inside yourself, muscles, in a sense, psychological muscles, don't underestimate the power of everyday positive experiences, those little opportunities in daily life to turn a passing positive experience into something of lasting value woven into the fabric of your own nervous system and body. So that's point number one, I would say. You know, there's a quote from the Buddha that I love. He says, "Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good." So that's my first point. Don't underestimate the power of little things. And then second point, really look for those particular experiences that are, I call, key resource experiences that target your particular issues or particular needs these days. And a roadmap for that, for me, is given in the evolution of the brain in three stages, the brainstem, subcortex, cortex, which is to say the inner lizard, mouse, and monkey, or safety, satisfaction, connection, broadly defined. In other words, if you're dealing with anxiety or anger or helplessness or trauma, those are key safety issues. If you don't feel peaceful inside your own heart, that's at bottom a safety issue. Well, look for experiences that help you legitimately grow a greater sense of internalized safety, like experiences of relaxing or noticing that your body is basically all right right now. It is, most of the time. There's enough air to breathe, enough water to drink, you're basically okay. Experiences of feeling protected, or you have allies who would support you, or experiences of your own resilience and grit and toughness. You know, those all speak to our safety needs. So if your red lights are flashing in the safety need category, look for the antidote experiences or the healing experiences that especially could help you feel like you're avoiding harms, okay? Or similarly, another key resource experience, target your issues for satisfaction. If you're grappling with frustration or disappointment or banging against a glass ceiling or discrimination, other forms of discrimination, or you've had a recent loss, shocking loss, right? These are issues in the satisfaction system. So you can shore yourself up by looking especially for experiences of gladness or the fullness of this present moment in your own mind or gratitude or accomplishment, or efficacy, like you can make things happen, you're a hammer instead of a nail, or wholesome pleasures of various kinds, meeting your needs for satisfaction. They're antidote experiences. And then last, social needs. if you're feeling hurt or ashamed or inadequate or envious or jealous or exiled, abandoned, left out, or insecurely attached, or lonely, or longing for love, or you're caught up in resentment and anger at others and aggressiveness even. If you're, in other words, having your connection issues, connection system issues there, look for experiences that make you feel more like you're attaching to others and meeting your connection needs, like feeling cared about in a variety of ways or feeling caring yourself. It may seem kind of complicated, but basically it's kind of like, what does your heart most deeply long for? Listen to the longing in your heart. Let your longing be your teacher. That's usually going to tell you what your North Star is, where your key resource experiences are located. Or another question is, what would have made all the difference in the world back then, maybe in terms of a longstanding issue? What inner resource, what inner experience would have made all the difference in the world? Or dealing, considering the challenges you're dealing with today, what would today make all the difference in the world as a psychological factor, as an experience or resource inside you? Any one of those questions will tend to guide you. The way I put it, what's your vitamin C? You know, for me, given my, you know, childhood of lots of rejection and loneliness, my vitamin C has been related to that third need for connection, served by attaching to others and feeling loved and loving. So I really have looked for my vitamin C in the realms of feeling cared about and also caring. But other people, their vitamin C is going to be in different areas. But as a takeaway, once you know, finishing up here, once you know what your personal vitamin C is, oh my gosh, everyday life becomes this amazing opportunity to look for or create vitamin C experiences. And then when you're having them, don't bring that pinhole of the mouth of those hungry ghosts, but bring a big spoon.
Oh, Rick. Oh, I love the vitamin C metaphor. Oh, my God.
Oh, that's great. Rick, good. I'm glad you like it. Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm just really, really grateful for all that you've been doing, your whole team there, the different centers you're associated with the greater good and your foundation. It's just, you know, we talk about peace from inner to international. And I think you really have brought in the wisdom of both modern science and ancient science and wisdom, and bringing it forward in a way that's just really, it's a huge gift, and it's really incredibly needed for global peace. So, Rick, thank you so much. And let me just remind people here before we go, rickhanson.net, lots of amazing resources. That's rickhanson, HANSON.net. So please go there. And Rick, again, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a complete pleasure, Philip. And what you're doing is honestly wonderful. And thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit summerofpeace.net. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.